Welcome everyone to this third event in our 2021 speaker series, Taking the Digital Welfare State to Court. My name is Jonathan McCulley and I am DFF's legal advisor. And with me behind the scenes are my colleagues, Judith Rauhofer, DFF's legal officer, and our events officer, Jihan Jadran. Together, we will try our best to ensure that this webinar goes smoothly and we do not succumb to any technical difficulties over the next 60 minutes. To give you all a bit of background to this series, for those who have not joined us already, over the past 2 years, the protection and promotion of human rights in the context of the digital welfare state has been a major focus of our work here at DFF. We've seen over the last few years how governments across the globe have sought to digitize the interfaces between individuals and public authorities and automate crucial decision-making processes that determine whether an individual's basic needs would be met. The key drivers behind this reliance on technology has been less to do with centering human need and promoting access, and have been more to do with cutting costs, reducing fraud, increasing efficiency, and downsizing personnel. We've already discussed these issues at a number of our workshops, like, for instance, our litigating algorithms workshop in 2019. We've also held a number of one-on-one and group consultations with a range of organizations working on the topic. And based on these consultations, produced a strategic document to inspire conversations on how strategic litigation could be used as part of a broader strategy to address the harms of the digital welfare state. You can find the document and more information about our other activities in this area on the DFF website. We also continue to engage with a range of other organizations on this topic, including racial, social, and economic justice organizations, as part of our ongoing Digital Rights for All project. Our objective here is to provide a space to the people who are most affected by harmful use of technologies and who are often underrepresented in digital rights policy circles to develop their own agenda in how to challenge these technologies through advocacy and litigation. This is a process that our colleague Laurence Mayer, who leads on the Digital Rights for All project, has summarized in a great blog post on our website, Nothing About Us Without Us. This year's speaker series seeks to complement that work by exploring a range of cases from different jurisdictions and relating to a range of different digital welfare issues to show how strategic litigation can be used by and in collaboration with these communities to protect their digital and human rights. So far, we have looked at legal challenges against techno-solutionism across a range of welfare contexts, from the use of electronic biometric IDs to determine eligibility for vital services like access to food rations, the profiling of individuals by algorithms to determine the nature and scope of government intervention that will be offered to them, and the use of automated statistical models to assess care needs and to determine how much care support an individual will receive. The topic of today's event is digital payments, protecting rights against the privatization of social security in South Africa. And we will be looking at the ongoing battle to protect social grants in South Africa. In 2012, the South African Social Security Agency entered an exclusive contract with a private company, Cash Paymaster Services, for the administration of South Africa's social security payments nationwide. Due to this contract, this company had access to the personal and financial data of millions of South Africa's poor citizens, and this data was subsequently exploited by third parties such as lenders, life insurance providers, and mobile money services. The Black Sash, an organization that has been working to protect social security and social protection and to reduce poverty and inequality in South Africa for 65 years, is currently running a campaign, Hands Off Our Grants, to stop, in their words, the unauthorized, unlawful, fraudulent, and immoral debt deductions from South African Social Security Agency bank accounts and to protect confidential data. To speak further on this campaign, and the threat posed by the privatization of social security in South Africa, we're joined today by Kuda Hove, who will moderate the conversation, and Wuda Abraham Faker, who will be speaking with us today. Thanks for joining us. Kuda Hove is a policy officer at Privacy International and currently leads the organization's identity work. He also works with teams across the organization to develop and implement the organization's policy strategies. Wuda Abraham Faker has a legal background, which he has used to focus on advancing human rights, As the National Advocacy Manager for the veteran human rights organization, the Black Sash in South Africa, she seeks to advocate for the right to social security with particular emphasis on social protection and social assistance to reduce poverty and unemployment. She previously used her expertise to advocate for access to justice and advance women's rights through impact litigation. I will shortly be handing over to Kuda to kickstart the conversation. And he and Wuda will be then spend about 30 minutes talking about the background to the litigation work Wuda has been doing as part of the Hands Off Our Grants campaign. While they are talking, we encourage all of you who are out there in the Zoom darkness to use the Q&A function to ask any questions that you might have for our speaker today. The Q&A tab can be found at the bottom of the screen on the right-hand side. We will have time at the end, around about 20 minutes, to allow Wuda to answer as many questions as possible that you might have. So please do use that function, and do try and use the Q&A function as soon as you have a question that comes to mind. There's nothing worse than coming up with a question and waiting for the Q&A bit, and you've lost it by the time you get there. So let's avoid that. Please just fire off your questions as soon as they come into your head, and we'll pick them up when we get into the Q&A section. So on that note, and without further ado, Kuda, Wuda, music to my ears, saying those two names together, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Jonathan. And thank you to the participants for making time this afternoon to join us. And most importantly, thank you to DFF for providing this platform where we get to learn more about how courts are being used around the world by different actors to promote, in this case, the welfare of people that depend on welfare systems. Huda, it's great to be talking with you this afternoon. To kick us off, to kick this discussion off, would you please tell us the background of the litigation? What were some of the issues that your organization was trying to address by taking this issue to court?
Sure. Thank you, Kuda, and thank you to DFF for allowing Black Sash to share our work. And so on that note, I'd just like to start by introducing you to Black Sash and providing a South African context. As Jonathan explained, we're a veteran organization and we're based in South Africa working towards the realization of socioeconomic rights. And to do this, we implement three programs: advocacy and partnership, community-based monitoring and research, and education and training, which works together towards achieving our objectives, and all are inextricably linked to work towards achieving social security. And this is important when we unpack the litigation, because the litigation as a strategy does not work on its own. There are elements of community-based monitoring and research, as well as education and training, especially to communities. And a key tool that we use is our constitution, which recognizes the right to social security. And just to outline what our constitution says, in terms of Section 27 of the Bill of Rights, it asserts that everyone has the right to have access to social security, including if they are unable to support themselves and their dependents, appropriate social assistance. And the obligation is on the state to make reasonable legislative and other measures within its available resources to achieve that progressive realization. And this is an important tool that we've had to use to advocate to hold the South African Social Security Agency, who's responsible for social grants and social assistance, and hold them to account. And this is especially crucial in a country where we face triple challenge of poverty, inequality, and unemployment, and where the right to social security is really significant. So it's this context that we live in that speaks to the challenges we face in South Africa, where our social assistance framework is extensive and 30% of the population receive social grants in the context of those who are disabled, those who are elderly, and those who are children. So it is a crucial lifeline for a big sector of the South African population. So bearing that in mind, let me try and respond to your question, Kuda. So when we look at the South African Social Security Agency, which I will refer to as SASSA, was established in terms of a legal framework, and it functioned under a Department of Social Development, which I will refer to as DSD. And they were responsible for the social development, protection, and welfare services to the public. So it is important for us to look at what is SASSA's responsibility. They are responsible for administering the information necessary to pay Social Security. They must manage the transfer of funds. They must establish a compliance and fraud mechanism. They must promote and protect dignity, and they must protect the confidential information held by SASSA. So this is very important because this speaks to the dilemma that we found ourselves in, which we call the SASSA, the social grant crisis. Now, in 2012, SASSA contracted a private entity, a single service provider, to distribute social grants nationally. And this private entity was Cash Paymaster Services, which I will refer to often as CPS. And they were a subsidiary of NetOne. They were contracted for 10 billion rand over 5 years to annually distribute on average 160 billion rand to 17 plus beneficiaries. Now, this appointment was an issue. It was controversial because it actually started a controversy in terms of the fact that they were granted this tender. There was an opposing bidder called AllPay Consolidated Investment Holdings, and they questioned the award of this contract to CPS. They challenged it in court, and they argued that there were several irregularities in the procurement process. The tender was constitutionally invalid, and it tended to favor CPS because it had this biometric element, which didn't give the other bidders an opportunity to respond, and also there was short time frame. The Constitutional Court found the tender process to be irregular and actually suspended this contract. But it was in a corner because there was this issue that social grant beneficiaries would bear the brunt of this issue. So the court said that the invalidity of this contract would be suspended to ensure that payments were not interrupted and could be administered by CPS so that beneficiaries could receive the grants that they depended on as a lifeline while SASSA got the house in order. It actually said that SASSA was required to undertake a new procurement process to find a suitable service provider or alternatively to insource grant payments. So from the off-go, CPS was a bad omen. It registered beneficiaries by collecting biometric information, which was your fingerprints. And despite paying for the services of CPS, they didn't have any supporting IT infrastructure nor card readers to access the biometric data. All the biometric information was collected and stored by CPS, NetOne, and Gridrod Bank. And there already were alarm bells going off. How could SASSA fulfill its mandate, as I'd outlined earlier, in terms of protecting the personal information of beneficiaries? The grant beneficiaries were issued with a SASSA Grindrod bank account and the cards, and they could either use a biometric fingerprint or a PIN to authorize the transactions. And so even though while CPS and NetOne was advancing this notion of banking the unbanked as a means of financial inclusion and actually looking at it and punting it as favorable to the social grant beneficiaries, their business model clearly showed a profit incentive with expansion in terms of their business model. It's important to see their business model because that became quite clearly illustrated in how the grant process was administered. They identified the social grant space as demonstrating an immediate need in a particular territory which they could respond to with deployment of required technology infrastructure and the registration of a critical mass of cardholders and customers, and then sell and implement its technology as the first wave of their business model. So this is crucial because they identified social grant beneficiaries as a customer base. Even though they were the vulnerable group of the South African population, they were receiving a regular guaranteed income from the state on a monthly basis. And then as a second wave of their business model, they would, once the infrastructure had been deployed, which they did in terms of administering social grants to a critical mass of customers, it enabled them to use this infrastructure to provide the social grant beneficiaries with an array of financial products and services for which fees would be charged. And this business model soon became very evident. Soon after the signing of the CPS contract, Black Sash, through its partnerships with advice offices and community-based organizations, we became aware of increasing number of beneficiaries reporting irregular deductions from their social grants, deductions that appeared to be linked to NetOne subsidiaries. I'm going to show you an example and give you a peek into an experience of a beneficiary. Now, Mrs. G was a pensioner living in a small grain-producing town in South Africa. She received an old age pension. She then noticed after CPS started administering grants that in November 2013, she saw that amount had been deducted from a bank account for airtime. Now, this was definitely an issue because Mrs. G did not own a cell phone. The next month, another amount was deducted. And so, too, we saw that in the following months subsequently. She sought help from the advice office in a town, and they then went to a local SASSA office to say, look, what happened to my money? She has no idea what deductions took place. They blamed her relatives for requesting airtime, but then never attempted to resolve the query. The advice office then approached CPS via its helpline to find out who had bought this airtime without her consent. They furnished her with a cell number where the deductions were coming off, but they couldn't trace who the name associated with the number, and they couldn't trace that it belonged to anyone in Mrs. G's household. And this was just one experience of thousands of beneficiaries who were experiencing deductions from their account with no trace of why it was being taken off, whether they had consented to it at all. And so through evidence collected by the Black Sash and its partners, it was apparent that from the first year that the SASSA CPS contract had started, it enabled NetOne and other subsidiaries to sell financial and other products to social grant beneficiaries, accruing large profits in addition to the 10 billion that they were contracted. So if you think of 17 million beneficiaries having an account and small amounts being deducted without them knowing, how much profit that would make for this company. SASSA had no oversight over the SASSA branded Grindrod accounts. The products were sold included airtime, loans, funeral policies, etc. Then they also introduced their own card, which was called the Easy Pay Everywhere card, which is a bank account similar to the SASSA Grindrod bank account, which they launched and was operated by a NetOne subsidiary. And beneficiaries also experienced deductions for this. And what was a very concerning element was that this Easy Pay Everywhere card looked very similar to the SASSA card. It had the Grindrod branding on it, and beneficiaries were encouraged to use this card because they said you could have access to loans, it would be cheaper in terms of being able to get withdrawal fees, etc. So beneficiaries were actually encouraged to open this EPE or Easy Pay Everywhere card, which really showed how their tentacles were circling or embracing beneficiaries who had no idea what was was happening, were not financially literate, was not explained in the language that they are familiar with, given that we have 9 official languages at least for beneficiaries to engage with. So these deductions were executed through a debit order and using a USSD platform link. And they also were able to share beneficiaries' confidential biometric data, which they collected during registration. So this marked the start of years of protected efforts by the Black Sash to get to the bottom of this injustice. And as part of the organization's objective of increasing the coverage and benefits of Social Security and social protection, we then initiated the Hands Off Our Grants campaign, which we called WIG. And the primary goal of this campaign was to stop these unlawful and unauthorized deductions. It was also to ensure that grant beneficiaries' personal and confidential data that was entrusted to SASSA was protected. And it called for the insourcing of administration and payment of social grant, because SASSA owned and controlled a recourse system that needed to be put in place, because the helpline or the recourse mechanism that was provided by this CPS was very, very difficult to contact in terms of the helpline, which was only in English. They charged you to be able to access the helpline, and also was not, they did have very limited face-to-face engagement. And so Black Sash was saying that that SASSA should take full responsibility for these debit deductions with bank charges. So really that is really the origin of the litigation, Huda.
Thank you very much, Huda, for that very interesting background. As we go on, why then was it important to engage the courts? Were there no other avenues? Had you maybe explored engaging with SASSA directly, or engaging lawmakers, or maybe a regulatory body that oversees the activities of SASSA and the welfare systems in South Africa? Why was it important to engage the courts? At what point did you decide we've done everything that we could? Now we're taking this to the highest court in the land.
Yes. So the thing is, Black Sash did not enter into litigation lightly. A litigation strategy is, like you say, really a last resort, because for many social justice organizations, litigation alone as an advocacy strategy has its challenges. It can be extremely expensive. It comes with a risk of devastating and crippling cost orders against civil society organization. There are also long time frames involved to make matters work through the system. And also there are challenges for maintaining the momentum of campaigns and the risk of actually not knowing what the outcome would be with such a consideration. So when we launched this Hands Off Our Grants campaign, we immediately engaged with the department. We addressed SASSA. We brought the challenges to SASSA. As you could see with Mrs. G, we didn't receive very much of a positive response. They were dismissive, saying that it was the beneficiaries' relatives. And through so continuous engagements and persistence on the part of Black Sash, where we communicated letters, we then had a meeting with the Department of Social Development and SASSA. And as agency, we brought community along, beneficiaries themselves who had experienced this. And through this engagement, the Department of Social Development, the minister at the time, was so moved by Mrs. G's story that she actually demanded that the airtime be refunded to Mrs. G. And so that lay the foundation for establishing a ministerial task team to look and consider the challenges that were facing beneficiaries. And while this engagement was taking place, there was also a concern as I explained with the All-Pay case, that the SASSA was instructed to find an alternative tender or alternatively to insource payments. So Black Sash was carefully monitoring the space, but there didn't seem to be any progress on the part of SASSA. They, despite the engagements with government, we were part of this ministerial task team to work on resolve these issues. There seemed to be no progression to address how grants would be administered when the CPS contract, although it was invalid, continued and their contract was deemed to end in 2017. So by 2017, early in 2017, Black Sash was concerned because there was no alternative contract that was being put forward. There was no tender process and there was no systems in place for Black Sash to be able to administer, SASSA to administer the payments themselves. So it was clear that SASSA had no plan to take over the payment of grants when the invalid CPS contract expired or indeed to outsource this critically important responsibility. This alarmed many civil society organizations, including the Black Sash. And then we approached the Constitutional Court to intervene. Now, Kuda, like you explained, the Constitutional Court is the apex of our court system. So it is the highest court in the land, and ordinarily you would not go to the Constitutional Court as the court of first instance. However, we made an urgent application because it was in the public interest. There stood to be 30% of the most vulnerable sector of our population being at risk of not receiving the social grants when the contract was coming to an end. We were concerned that the payments of grants to over 17 million beneficiaries stood to be compromised due to the failure of SASSA to ensure that it was ready to take over the payments by April 2017 or award a lawful competitive tenders timelessly. The result was that SASSA had no choice but then to enter into a further competitive contract with CPS, which would then exacerbate the long-standing concern of Black Sash that unlawful deductions were being made up from grants. The emergency situation created demonstrated that the Minister of Social Development at the time did not have adequate oversight over SASSA, and Black Sash requested that the Constitutional Court look at its oversight role in respect of the social grant payments and provide milestones as well as timelines to see what measures are going to be put in place. Because now what you had was CPS infiltrating further into the social grant space despite an invalid contract, despite it being suspended, despite the contract actually having come to an end in 2017, the court had no alternative but to extend its administration of social grants because there was no plan in place by SASSA. And the litigation amplified the uncertainty of payment and the role of SASSA and the Department of Social Development, as well as this issue of profitability of exploiting the poor. The outcome of the litigation was that the invalid contract between CPS and SASSA was extended by a year, and the Constitutional Court established a panel of experts to monitor and report on SASSA's progress over periods, regular periods of time, to ensure that they were putting measures in place to take over the grant payments. So the court also then had a supervisory role to be able to look at these reports, consider and analyze these reports to ensure that progress was taking place, to be able to ensure that there would be some limitation an extended period of time that CPS would be monitoring. And Black Sash actively engaged with this panel of experts, providing monitoring reports, testimonies, and case studies of beneficiaries' experience at all points during this court process.
All right. Thank you for that clarification. And You've already started discussing what the next question I had in mind, which was, what has the litigation achieved so far? You've already spoken about how, for example, there was the 1-year contract that had to be granted for the grant to continue, and there was an oversight mechanism put in place, the expert panel brought together. What else, what other changes can be directly linked to what the court decided back in 2017?
Look, the litigation opened a Pandora's box of issues much more than we thought. I mean, our primary concern was the beneficiaries, most notably the exploitative financial practices which led to the beneficiaries' grants being lost. Was really amplified. These practices were particularly insidious because deductions were made electronically from a beneficiary's account before the beneficiary was even able to access the account. So before even being able to receive the grant, they were already being shortchanged by not having full access to their grants. These practices also occurred with no risk to CPS because the money was automatically transferred. And then this raised the question and highlighted the responsibility of CPS performing a government responsibility. So with the invalidity of the contract, they recognized that CPS played a unique and central role because they were a gatekeeper to the right to social security and effectively controlled beneficiaries' access to social assistance. Therefore, CPS not only had contractual obligations with the government, but also had a constitutional duty to ensure that a workable payment system remained in place until a new one was operational. And so therefore, despite the suspension, the contract remained operational, but importantly, it said that it must remain bound to its contractual and constitutional obligations. So therefore, it was held that the CPS had no right to benefit from this unlawful contract, and any benefit that it would have been derived should not be beyond public scrutiny. So what they had to do is, at the end, as part of the order, CPS had to submit audited statements, which had to be audited by SASSA, to be able to make sure and consider the profit that was being made and whether it was feasible or should any of the profit be paid back. Now, regrettably, this matter is still hanging because in between taking this issue forward, CPS has not been upfront with the court. They were not able to provide all the statements for a full proper audit. And our partner organization, Freedom Under Law, raised this issue with the court and made an application. But in between not providing all the information to the court, the CPS and NetOne has also applied to be liquidated. So there is this issue that is still outstanding that Black Sash is playing a monitoring role over. And as I mentioned before, the supervisory role of the court is crucial because it also laid bare the issue of the public accountability when you're rendering a public service. And at the end of the day, that even if you're a private entity, you are still accountable in terms of your constitutional obligation. So that was an important outcome of the case. And also where there was this panel of experts who had different expertise to ensure that the payment of social grants would not be disrupted and held SASSA to account to make sure that they would actually have something at the end of the day in terms of a contract. And this forced or enabled SASSA or pushed SASSA to form a partnership with another state-led entity, who is the South African Post Office. And they also felt that this also would create more accountability by having a state-led hybrid model, which also was positive in the sense that as a result of this partnership, because of the deductions that had taken place with CPS, the account or the special disbursement account that was formulated through this partnership was a ring-fenced bank account. In other words, no deductions could unlawfully be made from this account before the grant was paid into the account. And most importantly, is also an outcome of this litigation was the protection of personal information, where BlackSash stressed the importance of ensuring that social grant beneficiaries' personal information was protected. Because despite the mandate of SASSA, they were not fulfilling the mandate. And so the court also held them to account to say that they are under a duty to ensure that there are adequate safeguards in place to ensure that personal data obtained in the payment process remains private. Another issue that was also highlighted as a result of this litigation was the issue of leadership and governance, where there was alluding to corruption. But the court considered through the court papers, there was this issue because of what was happening, why it happened. The court considered whether there should be a cost order made personally against the Minister of Social Development for her role that she might have played in the social grants crisis. The court reasoned that a cost order against state officials in their personal capacity was grounded in the values of accountability and responsiveness. And it was actually precedent setting where there was an inquiry held as to whether she should be held personally liable for this cost. And the outcome of this inquiry was that she was negligent and she had misled the court to protect herself from the consequences of behavior, in terms of which she had to pay 10% of the legal costs to both BlackSash and our other the other entity who was a party to this court case, which was Freedom Under Law. And with this inquiry, the court accepted the finding and also directed that the court papers should and the court order be forwarded to the National Prosecuting Authority to investigate whether she could be prosecuted for perjury and lying under oath. And this came to bear fruit where she is now in towards the end of November. The trial will be held in terms of a perjury charge against the ex-Minister of Social Development. And so too, when we're looking at the issues of leadership and governance, recently this came to bear fruit when the Department of Social Development reflected in the review of the SASSA Act. And they said that and actually mentioned this litigation process, highlighting the apparent governance weaknesses at the South African Social Security Agency. So there was many positives and many outcomes as a result of this litigation, highlighting particularly the protection of personal information and the role of digitization and balancing, you know, the access, the cost of digitization on the one hand, against the risk posed to recipients of social grants and how they were put at risk as a result of this introduction of digitization. What balancing act must you play to ensure that beneficiaries do not bear the brunt with the introduction of digitization in the social grant space?
Thank you, Huda. And a reminder to our participants, please do share any questions that you might have on the chat's Q&A function, and then we will queue up the questions and ask them during the Q&A session towards the end of the discussion. And Huda, what's next for the other stakeholders? You've won the case. The judgment has been passed. a few years has passed, and what's next for the stakeholders that are involved? You've mentioned what Black Session is doing, what government has done. What's next for the other stakeholders, including the recipients of the grants themselves?
Look, the rights of these beneficiaries have really been tested. Initially, you had unlawful deductions taking place. You now have the South African Post Office, which is taking over social grant payments. But that hasn't been without challenges just because of infrastructure and capacity. And so that has been a significant challenge where even NetOne shareholders had the audacity to contact Black Sash, recognizing and noting these challenges by the post office and saying, you know, we can provide a better service. So it's the lesser of two evils in terms of the fact that they had the technology, they had the infrastructure to make sure that payments were able to be done quite efficiently, but at the expense of beneficiaries' grants being deducted. And on the other hand, beneficiaries not receiving the full value of the grants because they have to spend money on traveling and having to expend bank charges. So that's the one issue that we continue to grapple with going forward. And the role of digitization has really come to the fore very strongly, especially in the context of COVID, which has accelerated digitization and in the space, in the social grant space, in the context of social distancing, where, you know, to not have long queues, putting people at risk in terms of health. So the government has funded the digitization of social grants in general as a means of paying beneficiaries. And in a recent World Bank report where they reviewed the social assistance programs and systems in South Africa, they held that the social assistance system may benefit from greater integration of technology-based solutions in the application, eligibility testing, and payment processes, as well as from addressing the fragmentation of the social assistance framework at an institutional level. And this speaks to what the department is doing as well as SASSA, because they are reviewing their regulations and they are also introducing digitization with hybrid models of application, which can be by default exclusionary, because you have to look at the South African context. How would this impact on the right to social assistance? We submit that the core objective of the Department of Social Development is oversight over policies that aim to alleviate poverty, and therefore must not introduce regulations which will have a contrary impact. The introduction of digital technology in the administration of social grants can and may further entrench economic and racial inequality if it's not managed carefully, because it must be balanced and looked in a context of South Africa and what our living realities are. In rural areas where many of the beneficiaries depend on social grants, there's no capacity and infrastructure. The national payment system is weak. There's no interconnectivity. There's not literacy in terms of how to use digital platforms. And so while there's not an aversion to digitization, that cannot be introduced without that balancing act of making sure that there are other measures in place to be able to access it. Because then what will be happening is that it will be exclusionary by default. And we can see that in the current context where with the COVID grant, South Africa's really been heavily impacted and affected by the consequences of COVID, where we've seen 40% more unemployment, or there's 40% unemployment in South Africa at the moment. And so recognizing that vulnerability of the unemployed, government introduced a COVID grant for the unemployed. But the reason why I mentioned this grant is exclusively an online portal. And so the question that is posed by Black Sash, does it exclude people because they don't have access to digital infrastructure to be able to access it, because at the moment there are between just over 8 million that is accessing the grant, where grants have been approved, but we can see that there are 14 to 18 million unemployed. So what is happening to those unemployed who would need the grant but are not applying for the grant? So those are just some of the questions, and we do have concerns because NetOne is still watching the social grant space in South Africa. In a recent meeting, the chief financial officer noted the following. He said there's been some recently published draft regulation changes that we expect to be enacted relatively soon, that we believe would make it easier for grant recipients to open and designate bank accounts in which they receive their monthly grant. This existing process is onerous and involves spinning out a form to a recipient that has to go and be hand delivered. The proposed change will make this process much simpler, but more importantly, it will have a significant effect on the willingness of recipients to move to a private sector bank account. And that's obviously a change that will benefit the financial services industry as a whole. So that's why it's really important that we need to look at this. We also then need to monitor government relationships to ensure the protection of personal information balanced with this profit incentive that we think will happen going forward.
Thank you. We're heading towards the last 6 or so minutes of our conversation, and the participant has asked for lessons that we learned from this case. So what, in your words, would you say is the learning point for people or organizations around the world that are litigating or thinking about litigating against the subcontracting of welfare state functions to the private sector, not necessarily in Africa, but in other parts of the world? What can they learn from this case? Maybe in about 3 minutes, if you could respond to that question.
Sure, thanks, Kuda. I mean, it's important that litigation be used as a last resort, as I've explained, because it helped us to make an application directly to the Constitutional Court. Otherwise, we would have not been able to, because we were able to say we've tried other avenues and it didn't work. We've engaged before, but unfortunately, it didn't work. And more importantly, it was also who would be impacted. When you're looking at public interest litigation, it is crucial to know who will be impacted. The amount of people is important, and also the extent of their vulnerability. So the fact that it was really the most vulnerable that would be impacted by there being no administrator to pay the social grants really allowed this urgent application to happen. Otherwise, we may have been redirected to a lower court before being addressed by this Constitutional Court. So that those two elements would be crucial. I think it's also always important to hear the voices of beneficiaries, and that helped in terms of our papers to illustrate and let the lived reality come through, and it not be a civil society organization speaking on behalf of beneficiaries, but let the beneficiaries' voices be heard. Like I've explained to you with Mrs. G's case, that's also that lived reality is crucial. And if through every stage of our engagement with government departments, we always had a presence of community and beneficiaries present, so that they themselves could hear their story, empower them, and grant them agency at the same time. So like I said before, our programs are always linked with each other, where we litigate. The media strategy is crucial as well in terms of informing and guiding, because, you know, it's although it was the beneficiaries that impacted, it was also the whole of South Africa that was indirectly impacted, because you looked at leadership, you looked at governance, you looked at corruption, protection of personal information, and so too, as a result of this, other government departments also then became parties to this to this action, which was crucial in strengthening and giving it, amplifying the issue through media as well. So I think it's really a multi-pronged strategy when you look at advocacy to be able to use all of it at the same time.
All right, thank you. And just one final question, one short question, hopefully with one short answer. Challenging the procurement process. So we're talking about strategies in addition to maybe strategic litigation. You mentioned in your discussion about challenging the procurement process, and you mentioned that the Constitutional Court also looked at the tender process behind the digital payments contract. Is this a viable tactic that people can use just to say, we are challenging how this tender was flighted, how the vendors were selected, and whether there was enough information or not? Would that be a viable strategy too?
Yes, no, definitely, because especially when you're looking at private entities and with digitization, you're not going to know before the time, you know, the impact that it has on beneficiaries. So the earlier you come in, and that's why with AllPay, the AllPay case, Black Sash was monitoring that, and we also intervened as a friend of the court to bring that perspective of beneficiaries and its impact. But because of the tender processes and the time issues, and also that SASSA was not, they were apathetic in making sure that there was another tender process, making sure that taking steps to insource it themselves. That was unfortunately the downside, which entrenched CPS to be in the space longer than they should have. So definitely, I mean, we always look at tender processes as a starting point, but sometimes that is not as transparent as it should be. You know, we in South Africa, we're not always knowing what is happening in terms of, and so we do work with other organizations and collaborate with those who have expertise. So importantly, we're not islands. We always draw on the strength of other organizations as well in terms of, you know, we're looking at tender processes, government processes, draw on their expertise so that you work together as a collective. That is also additional advice that I can add.
Thank you very much, Huda. I found the discussion interesting, and I hope our participants did too. Thank you very much to the participants for joining us in this discussion. And now I'll hand over to Jonathan.
That's great, Kuda. Thank you so much. Thank you for moderating this conversation today. And thank you, Huda, for taking the time to talk us through the crucial work that you're doing at the Black Sash to leverage constitutional protections to safeguard social security and social protection in South Africa. And the painstaking work that you've been doing to raise the personal stories that you mentioned of those affected by this privatization of social grants, like that of Mrs. G that you mentioned. Please note for those participants here today that this webinar has been recorded, and the recording will be made available on our website and our YouTube channel soon. For those of you who want to revisit anything that was discussed today, and you know, for those who could not attend, it'll be there so you can catch up with us another time. And for the academics among you, feel free to use this video for your teaching and your research. Our next event in the series will take place next week on Wednesday, the 3rd of November, when we'll be joined by Carla Clark and Amos Toe to talk about miscalculating income, taking on digitized universal credit in the United Kingdom. And there's still time to register for that event by following the link on our website. But for now, thank you to those who've joined us and participated today. Thank you for your questions. Thank you, Huda, Kuda, for this really brilliant discussion. Much food for thought. And yeah, I can see that we're nearing the hour. So without me waffling on any more for any further, you're now free to leave. Participants can now leave us. And thanks again.